This is North Shore Today for Monday, 11th day of January. Hi, everyone. I'm Bill Newell along with Rick Moore. And Rick, we begin our program. We'll get to some of the things that we have on our page in a moment. But we begin with some kind of tragic, sad news out of the city of Gloucester this morning with a house fire that's claimed the life of one person.
Correct, Bill. Saw it on the Gloucester Times had it this morning at 4 a.m. No details. I think Channel 5 is covering it. They're sending somebody over there. We can't get there this morning. It's in East Main. It's off of East Main in Hammond Street. And no details. A lot of talk on social media, but a lot of times some of that talk is correct. Our sympathies, of course, and prayers to the family involved, but just a horrible situation overall.
Right. So, and again, apparently, as Channel 5 is reporting, that they're that the one man might have been up on the second floor. That's where most of the damage was, and near Hammond and East Main Street in Gloucester early this morning. So, again, a very tragic way to start this week here today from the city of Gloucester. On our website, by the way, Rick, we've got a number of different things up there. We've got a few videos up there. As you know, there was no Powerball winner this past week, right? So I was checking around for some videos related to Powerball or lottery, and stumbled on these pranks, lottery pranks. I'll just leave it at that. It's kind of funny. And so So rather than give too much away here, but if you click on it, you'll see it. It's not that long, but some of these pranking videos are not that funny, and I'm not saying this is a laugh riot either, but hey, it is what it is, and it's kind of interesting. It kind of backfires. It's a prank that backfires, so I guess those are the best ones, right?
I have my opinion on those.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows?
For sure. Yeah.
And the other one, we have two other ones kind of from the genre of Saturday Night Live from from several weeks ago when Tina Fey and Amy Poehler were on Saturday Night Live. They did a bit called Meet Your Second Husband, I think it was, and so we have that on the show, and also on the webpage, and also down below, bringing us back to the 70s with The Price is Right and Bob Barker. We have a takeoff on that from Mad TV, so and that's kind of the way they kind of did a takeoff themselves on The Price of is Right. But anyways, it is what it is. I think it's Frank Caliendo that does the voice for the announcer. The old who is the old announcer on The Price is Right? I'm blanking out on that. But he had a classic voice, whoever he was. So
wasn't Gary Owen, was it?
No. It's no, I can't think of who it was. He's got a kind of a high-pitched voice. But if you watch that, you'll remember that voice, and I don't think that guy's there anymore on the show. All right, so that's those are a couple of things that we have on the program for today. And also, Christine Ramo, who is the executive director of the Gloucester Educational Foundation, we're going to feature that interview at the tail end of this broadcast today. She was a guest with Josh Arnold on Friday on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. So that's what we have on the program today.
Yeah, a couple of quick things, Bill. I know that you've got an interview with Gary Larrabee about a big event happening in Danvers, Danvers High School tomorrow night in sports. We've got a couple of guests lined up already for North Shore Sports Night tonight. And there's an article in the Gloucester Times this morning on the front page by Ray Lamont, who cites that the city of Gloucester could have taken over the back shore property that's in question now way back in the 90s for failure to pay taxes. There hasn't been any tax paid on it. The land has been deemed unbuildable. Now there are development processes in the works that could put as many as four house lots on the water side, on the rocks over on the back shore. So that's kind of an interesting article as well.
And I know locally, there's not a lot of local news. The Lynn item in Lynn had a story of a woman who was from Marblehead originally, now is the, I guess, a police chief in Seattle, Washington, and is going to be a guest of Hillary Clinton's at the State of the Union address, which is, I guess that's tonight, isn't it? Is it tonight or tonight or tomorrow night? One of those. It's coming right up, though. It's how much we know. But whatever. So, and also, there's a we've talked a lot on this program about the about the holidays and the holiday shopping and what that's meant and what it was like. And we mentioned a few stores. Last week was word that Macy's was closing two stores in Massachusetts, none in our area. But there's a story today in the news about Kohl's. So with the department stores have been under siege for decades, but let me just see here. This is the analysts expect Kohl's sales to total $19.3 billion for its current fiscal year, which ends roughly the same as 2012. So a number of retailers apparently are struggling, and they're seeing their sales and dwindle a little bit, or certainly not improve as they hope they might, and also stock values going down a little bit. So our retailers, you know, it's I guess, you know, we like to keep those stores around, but I guess more, less and less people are going into them for what traditionally was people would go out and grab stuff now. So.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, the convenience of being online is taking its toll for sure, just as the mall, you know, grabbed a lot of businesses away from the local cities and towns. So I guess it's evolution of one sort or another. I got to ask you a quick question, Bill. This thing on Sean Penn and El Chapo, does it make any sense? I'm sure you heard about it yesterday, but the fact that Sean Penn is not being considered a fugitive from justice himself leads me to believe that maybe he, you know, this whole thing was sort of a setup and that he was in on, and maybe they're not pursuing it or telling anybody because, you know, it could be a threat to his life as well. But the whole thing's kind of bizarre, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, I don't, frankly, I mean, I had not heard that theory that he was in on it, so I'm not. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but on the other hand, anything's possible. That you know, if knowing, I don't know Sean Penn well. I know a few things he's been involved with, it seems like. So to me, it sounds more like he went down there, you know, just as face, you know, we're hearing on face value, he went down, they wanted to meet with, met with him, and the guy wanted to tell his story. And, you know, obviously this guy walks out of a prison like he did several months ago. He's thinking a lot of himself and wants to tell a story in a movie, and Sean Penn's willing to do it. Those things almost add up to me, crazy as they are. And so I don't know. I don't know how to treat Sean Penn. I really don't. I know a couple of the candidates were asked that on the Sunday shows yesterday, and you know I don't know. I don't think we can really respond to it till we really know.
Well, the only thing I'm thinking of is you know, somebody, one of those candidates said, you know, it's his constitutional right. No, it isn't. That's aiding and abetting, isn't it? I mean, this guy's a fugitive, so it seems to me that's aiding and abetting. And so if you know who this guy is and you're going in to interview him, hello, then you're aiding and abetting. So I don't quite understand why Sean Penn is not being investigated or at least, you know, under arrest as well.
Well, you know, that may happen. I just don't know that it would happen. But, you know, again, if he went in there and I think your scenario is more likely. That scenario is that he went in there, not as a, not with our government knowing that he was going to do that, or our law enforcement officials knowing that he was going to do that, because I think he might be taking his own life into danger if, in fact, that he had may had those conversations, and then if it come out that he had done that, then I think he's a target later on. Those guys could go after him later on in the
exactly.
months to come. So that's why I don't see that being like I don't see that happening. That being the scenario. But what do I know? I'm just here on the North Shore with you, Rick. What do I know?
Well, we do know that we got some sportscasts coming up, and the Gary Larrabee interview is terrific. Geez, Gary is fun to listen to, and big night tomorrow night over in Danvers.
Yeah, they are. What they're going to do, and we don't know our broadcast plans for tomorrow night yet. We may or may not do a game tomorrow night, which is a normal basketball night. But tomorrow night, prior to the game, Winthrop boys are in over at Danvers for a boys' high school basketball game. But they're going to be honoring the 2014-15 Danvers High State Championship team, the undefeated team that went 27-0 last season. And so they'll be honored. A lot of the guys off of that team graduated, and thus they're back. The college break is still going on, so apparently this was the one date that they could get most of the players back. I'm not sure they got everybody back, but they got some of them back. Some of them are playing basketball now. So hopefully that should be a great night tomorrow night. We're actually heading over there tonight to Danvers. I think we're going to do a feature with a few of the players. We'll get that up because it's still – there's still – you know, obviously that was a fantastic season last year, and the program just completely turned around under Coach Walsh now in his sixth year at Danvers High School. So we'll probably try to get some stuff up on the Danvers boys basketball team. And I'm not sure what happens tomorrow night, but we'll see what happens. But that'll happen, I guess, just before the tip-off of tomorrow night's game. All right, and I guess the only there's not a lot of other things here, but, Rick, we're right on the border of New Hampshire, and, you know, I think the latest polls for the presidential primary came out this weekend, and these are really the first polls since the holiday break, as far as I know, and they show tightening races. And I got these poll numbers right in front of me, Rick, and in Iowa, the Democratic race is tight. Clinton is leading over Bernie Sanders by 3 points. However, in New Hampshire, Sanders has a 4-point lead over Clinton. What's interesting to me in that New Hampshire race is Sanders is at 50%. You know, it's always these pollsters, what they have to do is they really have to find out, you know, some people are, you know, not quite sure who they're going to vote for, so they kind of push them along and try to put them into one of the candidate slots or another, depending on the follow-up questions. But it's amazing they do have pretty much 100% of the vote accounted for in these polls. But Sanders at 50, Clinton at 46 in New Hampshire. So Sanders with a 4-point lead there. Then in New Hampshire, here's what's a little bit interesting, a little bit of a change is although Trump still has a 16-point lead, you know, by a lot of standards, that's not a safe lead. I don't think. I think he's going to win it. But on the other hand, Marco Rubio's the guy, the number two guy. And Jeb Bush is climbing up. We see a lot of Jeb Bush television ads down here in Massachusetts because of the where our market flows into our television market flows into a lot of New Hampshire. So Jeb Bush is in fourth place, but just 1 point behind Ted Cruz, who's in third place. And then on the Republican side in Iowa, it is Cruz up on Trump by 4 points. But I did watch yesterday, and one of the things is that all these polls are all based on a couple of things is the turnout model. So if Trump were in order, in essence, you know, getting more people out to the polls that don't normally go to these caucuses in Iowa, then that could flip-flop around. So Iowa's up for grabs, and apparently New Hampshire's up for grabs as well, as we're just now several weeks away from those two big decision points in the presidential race.
Well, I kind of yawn at that because I think those first two, in the long run, when you get down to June, May, June, July, nobody really remembers New Hampshire and Iowa. So I guess it's just kind of a slow news cycle right now.
Yeah, but they do. I think they build. They don't remember them, but they build and they do have impact. What happens in Iowa will have impact the following week in New Hampshire, or 10 days later, whatever it is, and so on and down the road. What may not have a lot of impact is what happens in New Hampshire than what happens in South Carolina. So we'll see there. All right, Rick, we have on our program today, we're going to Christine Ramo, the executive director of the Gloucester Education Foundation, is going to join the program in an interview that was heard on Trending Now. So we'll probably step aside at this point, bring that interview in, and at the end we'll just touch up on a little bit of sports. So, again, here's Christine Ramo with Josh Arnold on Trending Now from Friday morning.
Foundation.
Well, I am a nonprofit professional. I've always worked in the nonprofit sector. I'm actually from Pennsylvania originally, and I worked there for a few years before deciding to move up to New England to attend graduate school at Boston University. And when that was over, I started working. I worked for a couple of hospitals and educational organizations, primarily in the area of public relations and marketing and communications. And then I guess about in the mid-80s, I made the transition over into fundraising and development. I was working for the Scapin's Eye Research Institute at the time. I was a technical writer housed within the development department, and I became a full-fledged development person at that point. From there, I went to become the director of development for Project Bread, the Walk for Hunger in Boston for a few years. And then after that, I was recruited into a new position at an organization called Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic, which is a national organization that produces audio textbooks for children with print disabilities. There in the Cambridge office in the New England region for about 16 years. And about About 7 years ago, my husband and I decided that we had had enough of city living, and we moved up to Newbury, Massachusetts. And at that point, I was starting to look for a job that would allow me to not commute into Cambridge. And I found this job in Gloucester, and I've been here since I guess it's June of 2012.
Oh, great. So tell us about the Gloucester Education Foundation and what they do and how they work. And
well, we are a very grassroots nonprofit community organization that we are tasked with bringing resources into the Gloucester Public School District. Our mission is to drive innovation. We expand opportunities for students. We empower educators, and we encourage creativity among students. We fund a number of programs in science, technology, the arts, literacy, and just about anything else that might bring innovation and bring improvement to the educational experiences that students have. So far, since we've been in existence since 2006, we're entering our 10th anniversary year, and we have brought in about $4.5 million into the Gloucester Public Schools programs.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really significant. And the sources of funding that you bring in come from where? All private donations, or is there other foundations, or is it a little of everything?
It's a little bit of everything. A lot of our support comes from individuals in the Gloucester community, primarily Gloucester. It's a very generous community, we're fortunate to have many long-standing and consistent generous donors. We do raise some funds from foundations, and we also serve as a grant writing entity for the Gloucester Public Schools, because they don't have their own grant writer. So we have written some grants that have brought in some state funding for the 21st century after school programs at Gloucester High School and O'Malley Innovation Middle School, and we've also brought in some additional private funding that the schools wouldn't get otherwise.
Okay. Now, how does it work in terms of deciding, who gets what? I mean, are some things sustaining, meaning do you bring a program in and then have to then fund it every year?
Well, we tend, like most foundations, we don't like to keep funding the same the same programs year after year. Our feeling is that we like to act almost as venture capitalists for the schools, where we will provide some startup funding, and then if the program is successful, and many of them have been, then the school over time will find a way to adopt this and bring this into the school budget. Sometimes the schools come to us and ask for funding for specific projects or programs. And we have a process, we have a programs committee, we have an application process, and we review our applications very carefully, because we're dealing with donated money and we want to be good stewards of our donors' money. And we review the applications carefully. Sometimes we approve them right away, or we go back to the schools and make suggestions for how to change the program to make it stronger. And then for requests that are over $1,000, we send this up to our full board, and then the board will vote to recommend funding or not to fund something in some cases. Sometimes we see a need and we will go to the schools with a program idea, or go to a teacher or collaborate with teachers and administrators and develop a program where we see that there's a need.
Great. Now, what happened? I guess the question for me is, how do you deal with the budget mentality of people who are part of the public budget process, who might say, gee, we can cut the budget because the foundation will come up with the money for it.
Well, I think we make it pretty clear when we provide our grants that, you know, we're not an ongoing source of funding. We're not here to fill in gaps. We're here to bring in new ideas. We're here to bring in innovation and innovative experiences for students. We don't like to fill in the potholes. We like to build bridges.
Good. It's interesting you bring that up. Years ago, the state had a thing called the pothole money, which was funds made available on a city and town, a school district would apply for things that they couldn't afford in the budget, and you get a one-time injection of funds to do maybe buy some computers or the textbooks that they couldn't do the revision of a particular curriculum to get better spelling books or whatever, and there was that out there, and I wondered how your organization worked that you didn't become an organization to fill up the vacuum of things that are lost on the table when they go through the budget process. So that's very helpful.
Right. And you know, sometimes we do plug in the holes if there's a dire need. A couple of years ago, for example, GEF was providing funding for stipends for after school club advisors at the high school. And it wasn't, you know, each one of them was not a lot of money, but when you add them all up, it was maybe $10,000 a year. And over time, we worked with the district, and the district got into a position where it was able then to take this back into its own budget. But if we hadn't been there, a lot of that would have been lost for a couple of years. So occasionally we do that, but we don't like to make that a common practice. We like to get things started. We like to get things off the ground, and then have these become self-sustaining.
What are some of the grants that you've given, or some of the programs that have been started that may still be ongoing that were initiated through grants awarded from the foundation?
Well, one of our longest standing program is our high school program in robotics, and that actually started as an after school project about 10 years ago, and we gave money to the high school and the school organized teams of students to actually participate in the first robotics competition, and our students did well, and they enjoyed it, and the feeling at that time was, oh, there won't be very many students who want to do this, and we wound up with a group of 50 kids that were really, really interested in getting involved in this, and it was so popular that we actually gave additional money to have a curriculum developed around robotics, and now robotics is part of the way physics is taught at the high school.
Oh, that's great.
You know, some other projects that we have funded recently. Last year, we had a very generous donor step forward with funding for the photo lab at the high school, and that's now a permanent part of the arts program at the high school. The STEM lab, the science, technology, engineering, and math lab at the O'Malley Innovation Middle School is now self-sustaining. That was funded with grants from the Gloucester Education Foundation. So a lot of these things have really become part of the fabric of the schools, and that really pleases us immensely.
Now, you mentioned a board. Some things have to go before the board. Who is the board, and how long are their terms, and how do people pick, and how does that all work?
The board is mostly Gloucester residents, and in fact, I think it's almost exclusively Gloucester residents. I think about half of them are parents who have children in the schools who are interested in education and the schools. We have some retired people on the board. We have some business people, local business people on the board. So it's sort of a cross section. The board terms are 3 years, and we have, I think, we have a system now where board members can serve 2-3 year terms, and then maybe they step off for a year, and then they can come back if they want to. We have an annual meeting in December. We have a new board president this year, June Landigren Steele, who is a Gloucester High School graduate, and she herself is a professional development person who is retired. And we also have a clerk, a recording secretary, a treasurer, and a vice chair of the board, a vice president of the board. We have about 12 board members now.
Great. And what, in terms of external fundraising, the Regional Vocational School has a foundation, and they have a golf tournament every year. Are there certain things that you folks do in that regard? Or?
Well, we don't have a standing, regular on a special event. We'll probably be having one later this year in the fall, perhaps, because it is our 10th anniversary, and that's a good time to have a special event. We had a cruise event on the Beauport Princess 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago during the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
We just do a lot of major donor fundraising. We do some foundation grant writing. We have a lot of businesses in the area that contribute to GEF, and we do a couple of mail appeals every year.
Great. I know years ago the United Way had talked with the city. I think Bill Squillis was the mayor at the time, and it was they had set up an arrangement where if you wanted to give to the United Way, you could have a payroll deduction. Is that anything that the foundation does, or is that?
Well, we don't do a payroll deduction, but we do have a handful of individuals who have made a pledge to give monthly.
Okay.
To the organization.
Oh, good, good. And so going forward, what are there any special events or upcoming fundraising things or that the listening audience would want to know about?
Well, we are going to have a fun event in March 20th called The Power of Play. And this is really an event that will bring parents together and build community around the schools and around GEF. And this is going to be at the field house at Gloucester High School. And it's all parents and students of all ages are welcome to attend. And it's going to be a number of stations where people can go around and take part in activities in science and building and arts and fitness and things like that. And that will be, as I said, on Sunday, the 20th of March. We're going to be having our arts festival in early May, and I don't have the date at my fingertips, but it will be publicized. It's I think the first or second Saturday in May. The Mad Hot Ball is coming up on May 1st, which is an event that is for our fifth graders.
That's where they all get together and dance.
They all get together and dance. We fund ballroom dance instruction for the entire fifth grade at each one of the schools. And this is mainly to help them get some social skills and get an understanding of how to interact with fellow students and so forth. And then it's kind of like the fifth grade prom.
Yeah.
You know, they all get dressed up and go to the field house and participate in the Mad Hot Ball. And it's great fun. It's one of our most popular events. We also have our school musicals coming up in March and April. All of the elementary schools will be doing separate musical productions, and that's open to the public as well. And then we'll probably be having our special event sometime in October or early November of next year to celebrate the 10th anniversary of GEF.
Great. And if people wanted to contribute in some way to the foundation, how do they do that?
Well, they can mail in a check to the Gloucester Education Foundation, and our address is Post Office Box 1104, Gloucester, and that's 01931. or they can go onto our website and make we have a secure portal where they can make a donation. And I'm going to give you that website address. It is www.thinkthebest.org.
All right, welcome back. That was Christine Ramo from the Gloucester Educational Foundation with Josh Arnold on Trending Now from Friday. Rick, you were at a hockey game on Saturday night. That was a one-goal game and a Winthrop winning Gloucester.
Yeah, four goals second period. Put the thing away for Winthrop. They were outstanding in that second period, and they hung on at the end. Young kids getting a little tired there, you know, second half of the third period, but they hung on, good goaltending, and they got pick up their fourth win, and Gloucester very disappointed. They're stuck at 4-4 at the moment as well. But a good game, pretty good turnout too at O'Malley.
I actually was listening to the first couple of minutes of the broadcast in the car, and Winthrop scored what, a minute 17 in or something like that, or
almost scored right off the faceoff in the first period. Charlie Page was terrific, and then he came back on the very next rush, and he set up a goal. I think it was Henry Brooks scored. And, minute in, they get a goal. And they did the same thing in the second period. They scored two goals in the first minute and a half in the second period.
And I went over to Peabody watch, and Peabody defeated Swampscott 3-1. So Peabody's doing pretty well and under Coach Mark Leonard, and we have a post up on that on the website with some post-game videos with Coach Leonard of Peabody, Gino Fea, the coach at Swampscott High School, and a couple of Peabody players as well on the program. And I think it's Connor McCarron, a freshman, got his first goal of his career in that game, the third goal in the slot, just a classic, you know, pass from the wing to the slot, snapped off a sharp, crisp goal for Peabody for their third goal, and that was actually was a big goal because it was a tight game on Saturday night. So a little high school hockey action on Saturday here on the website. And folks, we'd hopefully, if you're hanging in there with us on the program here, that you'll tell folks about other folks about it. Follow us on Twitter. And if you have any questions or thoughts, you can always email us at our email address, which is posted on this post here, which is msonewsports@gmail.com, msonewsports@gmail.com. Obviously, we would like to hear from you. Rick, anything else from you?
No, that's it. I'm done.
All right, looks like a bright, sunny day today, a little cooler. A little less windy than yesterday, pretty stormy day yesterday, and looks like we might get some snow showers late in the day on Tuesday, so do watch out for that Tuesday night, late Tuesday, but not a lot of snow, maybe an inch or two at the very most. So with Rick Moore, I'm Bill Newell. This is North Shore Today on MSONewsSports.com.